I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I've literally had conversations with people, Richard, private conversations along the lines of, well, of course we know 1.5 is gone, but we can't say that publicly, because that might demoralize people, or we might get attacked. You know, that's the attitude that has to give way.
Why are there more sessions on fusion than there are on an ideal regulatory environment to use the technology we have to get to net zero in a sustainable way, right? Like, that should be the center of the conversation.
This is Wicked Problems. I'm Richard Delevan.
What if the missing climate tech that we really need isn't physical, but political? And what if without it, trillions of investment and breakthroughs in technology will be wasted before we wind up with a climate collapse anyway?
It's completely unrealistic to expect that political leaders are literally going to lead us through this of their own volition. It's going to need to be driven by popular demand. And that is a key motivation for why we think of this as being about the deepening of the climate majority.
I'll be presenting this kind of stuff at Innovation Zero, actually, with Shankar Gag, one of the world's leading dark matter physicists who teaches climate science with emotion. So he found that actually, if you let people learn climate science as humans and then talk to each other and let the emotions into the room, that a huge percentage of his class kind of changes what they want to do with their life so that they then get into climate tech.
When you first start to think seriously about the climate crisis, and then look for ways to cope, you've got some choices. A lot of people eagerly grab for the blue pill, hope it's going to be someone else's problem, and go back to finding ways not to think about it. And plenty of politicians are ready to stuff voters' mouths with as many blue pills as the fossil fuel industry can afford, leading even absolute legends like outgoing UK Climate Change Committee CEO Chris Stark, in his valedictory interview with the BBC, sound, well, when presented with recent examples of that blue pillism here in the UK, from the government he works with, well, he sounded sad.
The Prime Minister ditched some of the measures and slowed down what you've been talking about in the autumn. What was your honest reaction to that speech?
It was presented to the country as, a step back from going too fast on this transition. And indeed, in the speech itself, we talked a lot about the need to reappraise lots of the steps that take us to net zero. My honest answer to that is I think it set us back. It doesn't matter that there were detailed policies within that speech that you could say were very much in line with net zero. The overall message that other parts of the world took from it is that the UK is less ambitious on climate than it once was. And that is extremely hard to recover. The trouble is that the kind of rhetoric for this has definitely changed recently.
But many people try and do something positive, like Chris Stark. Some double down on the science. Some people get into activism. Some people switch track from big tech to climate tech. And those last two routes can be satisfying, for a while. Sometimes those people have trouble talking to each other, or, at best, are skeptical of the other's approach.
I have found climate tech folks to be, on average, rather magical thinking and rainbow unicorn piss types to some degree. Rainbow unicorn piss being the magical fuel that will drive all of green industrialization.
That was Tajio Müller on the show earlier this year. He saw both routes as being dead ends unless they lead you to his position, just collapse or prepping together. Before talking to Tajio, I thought that sounded like giving in to despair. Until he told me the story of his friend who, having seen a teenager shot in front of him in Stockholm, and thinking we're going to see a lot more of that kind of bad stuff as things fall apart, basically learned field medicine and taught others how to triage a gunshot wound. That's dark, but it is the opposite of defeatist. And on the other side, there are people who see the activist track as sometimes moving things in the wrong direction.
There was a protest not so long ago. There were people here basically shutting the place down. You clearly feel that that kind of protest has been detrimental to the cause.
I do, actually. I mean, I think we've got to view this as a genuine transition. We've got to be more tolerant of the fact that we are not simply going to switch this stuff off. The most successful transition is the fastest transition that everyone supports.
Everyone supports. Kind of caught my attention. I think that might have been a slight misstatement. But I think it is a fundamental question we have to ask, which is, can you actually do the transition with just the support of a technocratic elite? Some public support? Majority public support? How do you sustain it? There's no shortage of books over the past 20 years by activists or technologists or scientists that diagnose the cause of the climate crisis. And the solution that the author thinks that you're a complete muppet if you don't get, in dogmatic terms. A lot of must and cannot. Doesn't mean they're not thoughtful people. Doesn't even mean they're wrong, necessarily. I went back and did a little experiment. I took a few sample books and compared, for each of them, how often they use the words must or cannot, and compared that with the number of pages. It's crude, but the results were interesting, probably bear a little bit more investigation in the future. On one end, I looked at Pope Francis's papal encyclical, Laudato Si, literally from a guy who does dogma for a living. On any given page, you'd have a 69% chance of one of those words appearing. In between were people mixing interviews with some of their own opinions, like Akshat Rathi's Climate Capitalism, 10%, or Solitaire Townsend's The Solutionists, 10%. There are outliers. Climate Leviathan, a political theory of our planetary future by political scientists Joel Wainwright and Jeff Mann, 108%. So basically, you'd be guaranteed to see must or cannot at least once on every page. On the other hand, Bill Gates' How to Avoid a Climate Catastrophe, you'd have just a 4% chance of reading those words on a page. Of course, that might be that Gates can afford a better ghostwriter. So when I read The Climate Majority Project, the book written by co-founders of a new organization with the same name, led by social scientist Liam Kavanagh and political strategist Rupert Reed, at one time the public face of Extinction Rebellion, I expected it to be more like Climate Leviathan and less like Solitaire Townsend's Solutionists. In fact, it clocked in at about 30%, which, given it's a call to political organizing and action, confirmed what I felt reading it. That was aimed at a much tougher project than proving a thesis and trashing your opponents. It's the hard yards of coalition building, and seems guided by the idea that being right is less important than actually getting to a solution. I really enjoyed our chat, and I was surprised that with their pragmatism and view of the need to square up to reality and have adaptation be a much bigger topic for discussion, they went through a similar process to Tajir Müller, and probably have more in common with him than a given Twitter spat might lead you to think. I'm at the Adapter World Conference today in Munich, on climate adaptation, finance, technology, etc., organized by our previous guest, Ulrich Seitz. And I'll let you know how it went very soon. If you're enjoying Wicked Problems and these climate tech conversations, do come on over to wickedproblems.earth and consider maybe chipping in a few bucks that would allow us to continue and even expand what we're doing. And for those listeners who are already supporters, Prost. Sie sind der Beste. Now, here's our conversation. Welcome back to Wicked Problems. I'm Richard Delavin, and I'm very, very happy to be joined today by two of the most thoughtful folks leading a new project in climate action. Rupert Reed, Assistant Professor of Philosophy, and also a former strategic director and spokesperson for Extinction Rebellion, and Liam Kavanagh, a social scientist and specialist in cognition who helped found the Life Itself Project. Gentlemen, thank you for joining Wicked Problems.
Great to be here.
Great to be here.
And you both are co-authors and co-directors and founders of a new initiative called the Climate Majority. So first of all, what is that? And if there is a climate majority, can it actually do anything?
So we think there clearly is a climate majority. Polls are very clear that the majority are now concerned. But we think that the climate majority needs deepening and it needs activating.
Which is why we call it the Climate Majority Project, actually.
Yeah.
Because there is this climate majority, but the project part is turning it into something that can take us where we need to be.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so, I mean, I guess with a lot of things, there can appear to be a majority support. And I know that I've seen, Rupert, in other presentations, you show some polling data from Ipsos Mori, you know, showing wide majorities of the UK public in favor, you know, are concerned about climate, and indeed, in some cases, would be willing to potentially risk economic growth in order to be able to, you know, kind of commit to climate actions. You've been in electoral politics, so have I. I think that when you do a polling question, sometimes you can get a result that's very, very broad. What is it, an issue on which people actually will decide to vote? So is it deep? Are they committed?
Exactly.
So I guess, is that part of what this project is for, and how are you going to achieve that?
Yeah, absolutely. So as Liam says, that is integral to the point of the project. And one way of understanding our aim, this is not a short-termist venture. We don't think there is any shortcut to getting where we need to be. There's no techno shortcut. We'll come back to that probably on this podcast, I'm sure. There's no electoral shortcut. There's no shortcut through nonviolent direct action. Whatever we do, and we need to do a whole slew of things, it's going to take time. It's going to be gradual. It's going to be painful. It's going to be a bit like perhaps as depicted by Stephen Markley in a book that you and I both admire, The Deluge, extraordinary, broadly utopian cli-fi novel that's just recently come out. And yeah, we are in business to try to make that transformation happen as quickly as it can, but with full awareness that that isn't going to be terribly quickly. And a key part of that is going to involve political change. But what we think is that it's completely unrealistic to expect that political leaders are literally going to lead us through this of their own volition. It's going to need to be driven by popular demand. And that is a key motivation for why we think of this as being about the deepening of the climate majority.
Yeah, and catalyzing a deepening that's kind of already underway, right? The other idea is that basically this is a trend that you can then catalyze, right? And knowing that you're part of this trend actually helps to catalyze it. So if people realize that, yeah, I'm actually part of an emerging climate majority, a movement that's already starting, there's a point of self-consciousness or collective consciousness that this movement has that itself helps to push it forward. So that's a big part of what we do in many ways.
Right. And I want to come back to that because I think that there's a lot of interesting things around how majorities become aware, you know, whether, and I mean, there's going back 200 years in terms of the social science on this about whether or not consciousness can be shared, if it's a false consciousness, how do you actually have other forces that are trying to, you know, change, put their fingers on the scale, change some of those outcomes. But I want to come back to you, Rupert, for a moment. I mean, I think for a lot of people listening to this podcast, they probably have heard your name, but they're not sure why, in the sense that, you know, you are on telly and radio quite a lot, you know, are a noted commentator in The Guardian, other places over the years. But you also, I think, perhaps became most noted for your involvement with Extinction Rebellion, which you then decided, if I understand correctly, because of decisions that they were making on tactics, decided to leave and kind of moved in the direction that led you to this project. Can you just shed some light maybe on, for the benefit of the audience, but why you decided to move from something that people identify as one of the big kind of name brands, as it were, in climate activism to this?
Yeah, well, so I had 2 years inside XR and they were tremendous years. We really achieved something. We forced a national conversation in the UK to some extent around the world. We changed climate consciousness and that's great. But it became clear to me and to a lot of other people in XR that XR appeared to have reached a bit of a ceiling, really. In retrospect, one can, I think, date that moment to October 2019 when in the second British Extinction Rebellion, the largest ever. There was the infamous incident at Canning Town of some rebels stopping a tube train. And that was, if there was one moment where the fortunes of XR can be marked as having reached a kind of plateau and started to go downhill. I think that was it. Anyway, I noticed that quite a lot of people, by no means just myself, quite a lot of people in XR were starting to move on and starting to create typically more moderate, more mainstream, more mainstreaming movements, organizations, activities, etc. The big exception, of course, being Roger Hallam, who went off to go more radical than now with Insulate Britain and then Just Stop Oil. But I noticed that there were these climate hubs developing, climate emergency centers. There was Community Climate Action. There was Lawyers for Net Zero. There was Wildcard. There was MP Watch. I could list a number of other quite creative, novel initiatives of people who had been in the XR space deciding to really try something new. And so I started to reflect on that and started to write about it. And it became clear to me, partly through conversations with Adam Woodhull, who now runs Lawyers for Net Zero, which has been renamed General Council Sustainability Leaders. They're trying to organize senior corporate lawyers for climate action, very much not your usual suspects. Mm. It became clear to me that what we did indeed need was a new moderate flank, what we now call the climate majority, right. What we seek to mobilize through the project, that you were never going to get the majority of people getting behind the kind of thing that XR was doing. And that there was no way we were going to succeed without the majority behind it. Therefore, there had to be this mainstreaming strategy, and that's what we're doing.
Right. Because the XR's kind of theory of change was that you need this 3.5% of a population, and based on some slightly contested social sciences studies about, you know, kind of how you move populations. I noticed the same study gets quoted. I'm unusually here in the States this week for reasons that I won't bother people with, but you know, I have spent enough time here even over the last 20 years since moving abroad that 3% also happens to be on a patch of people who did a lot of stuff on January 6th at the US Capitol. So there's a lot of folks on both on different ends of the political spectrum, on all ends of the political spectrum, who take that 3% or 3.5% piece to be, you know, some kind of magic number. But you kind of moved in a direction where there is a presumption, and again, I'm going to quote maybe a line from the book, because again, if people haven't had a chance, available in all good bookstores, the Climate Majority Project book, I very much recommend it. But one of the things you assert is that understanding that widespread popular cooperation to halt global overheating is needed will, in this environment, become more and more like common sense. And the worsening climate situation is pushing us towards a social tipping point in climate awareness and action. And while that felt true in 20, even perhaps before that tipping point, that climax in 2019, it feels like since then there has been a change. We saw in boardrooms, we saw in BP, we saw in Exxon, we've seen the leaked recordings and kind of documents that suggested they were really scared of XR. They were scared of Greta. You know, they were scared of the Sunrise Movement. But that has since kind of abated to mm-hmm. some extent mm-hmm. as, you know, people who, from a different political persuasion have kind of come back out fighting, as is the fossil fuel industry.
Yeah.
So why are the statements that you make in the book kind of self-evident, if the idea that the worsening data on the climate, which is getting more dire every week, and listeners to this podcast will know, we've covered in various episodes how the data has changed, you know, and how 1.5 is increasingly out of reach. But why does the knowledge of that then therefore somehow lead to people doing something differently than they have before?
So you've drawn attention, I think, to the rise of the populist hard right. Now, the climate majority, it's mostly, if you will, below the radar, but it's very much there and mobilizable. That's what, for example, some of the polling data that our collaborator People Get Real has revealed has shown. It's what some of our own audience research has shown. What is needed is for the climate majority to find its voice. Liam, do you want to elaborate on that? Because it's very much your thing.
Yeah. I mean, there's a number of things here. I mean, first of all, that, you know, it's good to say, I mean, first of all, it's to say that over long term, if you look at like worsening scientific consensus and worse data, you have these like year-to-year changes. But if you looked at those two things on a long-term trend, there is a, you know, a very positive correlation. So I wouldn't necessarily take 2019 till now kind of as the, you know, as written. I mean, there was a very like powerful movement, and it did kind of turn out not to be a theory of change that had legs as far as changing society. So that's one thing. But then, yeah, the other question is, okay, well, how do we actually get the majority to stand out and let each other know that we exist, we're organizable, right? So, I mean, part of it is things that are not the usual suspects, right? So people are not the usual suspects doing unusual things. It's what does urgency look like? So getting large numbers of people to do things that show an amount of urgency that is not usual by people that are not usual, right? Because what people get motivated by is people like them doing stuff that they wouldn't normally do, right? So, because people need to know essentially on climate, I'm not alone, right? The system is screwed and everybody else knows that it's screwed as well. And what is it? What is actually knowing it's screwed look like? You know, you have to then ask, and what you can talk about it all you want, but when you start to see it, then that's different, right? So, you know, the question is, how do we plan actions that are large enough, get enough attention and involve enough people of a different kind of political persuasion than normal that send the signal, a new signal, okay, climate action by the mainstream has now kind of reached a new level, right? There's basically, you know, some people use a phase shift. You can just call it a dam bursting as well. I mean, so another thing to point out is that, like, yeah, there's pressure building up, and then social change tends to happen all at once. XR was, you know, another argument is that XR was an example of increased pressure. People were noticing in the middle of the last decade that the weather was getting worse. Lots of people were talking about it. Then finally, enough of those people organized something that got on television, and everybody felt a lot less alone because they actually saw XR, and there was this Overton window change, right? The strategy didn't turn out to work for many reasons. I mean, you know, the 3.5 number is not realistic. That's drawn from the Arab Spring data. Those people represented like 60-70% of the population.
Yeah, that's absolutely key, right? And Erica Chenoweth herself says this now, that you need at least like 25% to be active if you're going to get actual social transformation. And that's what we're aiming for. So in terms of the fossil fuel companies and the other corporates who you spoke of, Richard, as sort of breathing a bit of a sigh of relief that the pressure on them has dropped somewhat. Well, we want to, if you will, make them wake up and make them scared, perhaps make them pay attention in a whole different way by having such huge numbers of people who are making change and demanding change that this is undeniable and can't be pigeonholed as just, you know, a group of radical activists or what have you.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's come to the theory of change. But I mean, because I think that it's the great kind of nut of the whole book. And I think, you know, encapsulates the thinking. Both of you worked on it. It has four strands. It starts out with essentially telling the truth more accurately, I suppose. So why is that important? And you talk in the book about things like something like soft denial. So what is that, and what does it mean to tell the truth more than people have been right now?
Hmm. Well, of course, there has been a wonderful shift since about 2018 in terms of a much greater degree of truth-telling entering into public debate through Greta, through XR, through David Attenborough, and so forth. And the way we see it, the truth is something which is an enormous power for liberation and mobilization on a very, very wide basis. It's not something which you can keep as the property of scientists or activists or people in NGOs or in the movement. I've literally had conversations with people, Richard, where those people said things, private conversations along the lines of, well, of course we know 1.5 is gone, but we can't say that publicly because that might demoralize people or we might get attacked. You know, that's the attitude that has to give way. And we strongly believe that in the right context, telling the difficult truth is enormously powerful. Tell us about the context, Liam.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is I mean, the way to introduce the four strands in some ways, like, well, what do we hear about not telling about how we should tell the truth? Well, we can't talk about the whole truth because we're just going to depress people, right? And this is basically, as a social scientist, you know, basically I'm used to non-replicable results and people not really thinking things through, how generalizable things are. And, you know, what I look at is like, well, what did you do in those experiments that you're quoting? Well, it's basically like isolated people getting a message about how bad things are. And then we kind of, you look at how this moves their behavior. Well, social context is all important, right? The whole takeaway message of social psychology is that context, the context that a person operates in determines their behavior. The Milgram studies, Stanford prison experiments, you know, I won't go into explaining that, but people can, a lot of your viewers of smart people probably heard of it before. So how do you create the context in which people hearing the truth turns into inspired action, right? So that's the question you should be asking. If someone had this kind of message coming in, wow, everything is so bad, and there's a movement you can join, there's something you can do, and you'll be part of something much larger, like a climate mobilization, right? That's, you know, sort of, there's an invasion, we have a fearsome enemy, we're going to do something about it. You know, millions of people have the same idea, there's a plan, you can be part of it, right? Then people don't kind of hide it in their bed or just get depressed. They do something. So the question has to be, how do you create that context, not just give people a message that makes them feel better, right? So, I mean, that's really, you know, the basic. So the four strands are about, well, how do you create that context, particularly with a distributed movement?
Yeah. So the idea then that the four strands are, we can now say, first strand, truth, truthfulness, telling it like it is. Second strand, handling that difficult truth together, doing shared, you know, work, dealing with our climate distress, etc. Third strand, practical ways, pragmatic ways of taking action together in wherever the places are that you have, that we have actual or potential power or voice. So we place a special stress on workplaces, businesses, also communities where people actually live. And the fourth strand, the cross-cutting awareness of all of this, the awareness, as Liam said, that you are part of something that is emerging and that is going to keep growing because the weather is going to keep getting worse for quite a long time to come. And people are moving and are waking up. So when you put these four strands together, then you don't have isolated, depressed people. You have something very, very different and something actually hugely exciting and encouraging.
It might be worth adding for your viewers that you can base this in kind of relatively basic industrial organizational psychology, right? If you look at motivation, it's, you know, what motivates a worker? Well, it's the feeling that there's something that they have that they can actually accomplish and that will in turn result in something that, in the overall goal being achieved. So that's three of the strands there is like there's truth of the situation, the action I can do. And then what's missing usually from climate is the feeling that there's other people out there that are going to execute the complementary actions such that whatever little thing you can do actually turns into something larger. And then there's this additional one of kind of inner work in that, like, this is actually a very emotional situation. So people who can't handle their emotions get overwhelmed. It's also basic psychology. So, you know, performance psychology, like athletic performance, is about essentially managing your level of arousal so that you don't get overwhelmed. And people, if they have an action that they're confident in and they have, you know, quite high level of physiological arousal or fear, and then that can be channeled into an action, right? But these are like, this is basically basic kind of performance science is, you know, the grounding of the strands in one, you know, way of looking at it, which is, you know, sort of fits with all sorts of other ways because it's just good common sense. So it's been showed up in philosophy.
I think and in terms of the audience, people listening to this, a lot of, we'll over-index for people who work in communications and people who have done some of that work. So I think the, you know, that four-step theory of change is going to look familiar to a lot of people in the sense of whether it's change management inside an organization or it's trying to build a public narrative about how to, you know, kind of describe a different world with a problem and a solution. You know, and indeed people who do pitch decks for raising money for climate tech companies who work listening to this right now, all of that will seem very familiar if they've been doing their homework.
Perhaps worth mentioning though, Richard, perhaps worth mentioning that We do think that the second strand, the strand of shared inner work, handling the difficult truth together, tends to be somewhat neglected. It's been a bit of a poor relation. And that's one reason why one of the key campaigns that we're leading ourselves is on resourcing climate distress, making the process of handling that difficulty something which isn't taboo, but which is visible and accepted.
Mm-mm-mm. Yeah.
Yeah, Chim. And I think, and then I've talked about this. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Liam.
No, I was saying, you know, Shamkar Gag, who's a will be at Innovation Zero, so I'll be presenting this kind of stuff at Innovation Zero actually with Shamkar Gag, who's one of the world's leading dark matter physicists. So the leader of the Kale Dark Matter Experiment, and you know, who teaches climate science with emotion. So he found that actually, if you let people learn climate science as humans and then talk to each other and kind of handle their emotions, let the emotions into the room, that a huge percentage of his class kind of changes what they want to do with their life so that they then get into climate tech. So, you know, if you want lots of talented employees, you might tell your viewership to support that type of education. Mm-hmm.
100%. I think, I mean, we've talked on this show before about that, you know, there are very few people who think seriously on this topic. And I don't know if I could count myself as someone who thinks seriously on it, but certainly I've encountered something similar, is that you think about this very seriously, particularly if you have kids, particularly if you're thinking about the future, and you hit a wall of despair, and yeah. guilt and shame, which can be either paralyzing or, you know, can lead people into all sorts of further states of distress, or can be a turning point in people's lives.
We're going to take a quick ad break and come right back. So stay tuned.
Hey, here are some ads to help pay the bills. If you'd prefer a version without ads, subscribe to our member feed at wickedproblems.earth. A monthly subscription is cheaper than buying us a pint.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Yes,
and I think that's why, so I think you're right to put the emphasis that you do, and I think it deserves more. And I think glad that, so thank you for doing that, and thank you for positioning it in that way. I guess one of the other things that you talk about in this, staying with this theory of change or the different strands for a moment, is in terms of these, you know, kind of communities of awareness, so the tangible pragmatic actions, because it's something that feels a little bit different in the way you describe this than I've heard it described other places, but I want to understand it better, in that you spend some time in the first strand talking about, as you've already mentioned here, that there's a open secret that 1.5 degrees, you know, the kind of acceptable limit in the Paris Agreement terminology, is now just being demolished by the data. Even though, you know, whenever I talk to someone on the record, they say, well, we don't know yet. Well, Copernicus, you know, just one year of data. We have to wait. We don't really know. We wait for 5 years and see how it works out. And like, that's a deeply unsatisfying answer. You want to raise someone's climate distress, that's a great way of doing it. So you talk about the tangible actions. And one of the things you focus on is adaptation being a way in for people in ways that simply talking about waiting for government to do something, passive stronger version of the IRA here in America, or the Net Zero Act in the UK, that there are ways of making people feel, importantly, more involved, more empowered, and that might have interesting effects. So maybe talk about that aspect of it, the tangible actions.
Yeah, well, I'm delighted you asked about that, because that is an increasing focus of our work. We talk about it in the Climate Majority Project book, but we're going to be talking about it a lot more over the next year or two. I'm going to be launching for us a campaign called Strategic Adaptation for Emergency Resilience, which nicely abbreviates to SAFER, which is what the right kind of adaptation, properly undertaken and resourced, will make us. And the key thing about adaptation, which you've already alluded to, the absolutely key thing, which we think that people haven't fully realized yet, is that when you start to get serious about adaptation, when you talk about it, when you start doing it, when people actually see other people doing it, or when they do it themselves, it makes the thing real, right? Whereas greenhouse gases, you know, what are they to most people? 2050, that's a lifetime away. A colorless, odorless substance which does all this damage, you know, gosh, it's all terribly abstract. Actual work on a river and its course, or on what you're going to do to your food system because you're aware of the climate disasters that are coming and that the worst shocks that are coming. This makes it real to people. This brings home our vulnerability and brings home that we can do something about it and that we can make ourselves somewhat safer. So for so long, adaptation has been the poor relation and the focus has been so much on prevention and mitigation. It's totally understandable why. But we think that part of the reason why that has persisted beyond when it should have persisted is that people have been unwilling to take themselves into the full-scale reality check, which is implicit in taking adaptation seriously. And I mean here also including, you know, right-minded politicians and good-hearted activists and so on and so forth. They've been reluctant to go there. They've been reluctant to let go, for example, of the dream of 1.5, because they too, and we too, all of us, some of the time, don't want to face up to the awful reality. And that's, of course, soft denial, which is incredibly widespread. We've probably all got some of it some of the time. So we think the incredible power, the strategic power of strategic and transformative adaptation is that it lances that boil and takes you into the new reality. And you know what? It's unavoidable that we go there. And the sooner we go there, the better it's going to be. The question of how to get serious about adaptation is going to become an increasingly preoccupative question. And those who avoid it are losing the chance to set the agenda there. You know, I sometimes say the struggle to define adaptation adequately will be the defining struggle of the next decade. And I really mean that. So we need to get on board with it now. And that's what we in the Climate Majority Project are doing. And SAFER is going to involve crucially working with local communities, including, for example, communities that are facing flooding threats, trying to organize those communities. There's a potential dimension with the insurance industry, which is, of course, one of the ways that we cope with vulnerability traditionally. What if insurers started to change their policies such that the need for adaptation were included in those policies? You could get reductions on your premiums or whatever if you moved into a more adapted space. We're already talking with civil servants who are privately extremely concerned about the dire situation into which we are moving, and mostly under the radar and sometimes without ministers even being very aware of it, are getting busy with adaptation, with resilience building, with preparedness. So SAFER is coming, and we think it's sorely needed, and we think it's a game changer. And as I implied before, the really exciting thing about the way it's a game changer is that because it's going to make the whole thing real to people, it's going to actually help the mitigation and prevention agenda as well, right? So I make the following paradoxical claim. The best way that you can now get serious about triggering real efforts to mitigate and prevent dangerous climate change much more than we have at the moment, the best way you can do that is by getting serious about adaptation.
So don't, you know, so having schools tell their kids to go home and lecture their parents about which bins to have for recycling, perhaps less effective than, you know, showing people a flood map.
Yeah, exactly.
And what they need to do about it. I mean, so because I guess that you've already kind of answered the question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. I mean, one of the resistance to discussing adaptation in the past has traditionally been thought of as being A, it's going to deter mitigation efforts, and that it might steer funding where it otherwise might be usefully employed in other areas. To a global justice aspect of it, where it's been convenient for the United States and other oil states to be able to say, well, we can't really because of it will disproportionately affect frontline states in the global South, and that's where we can't really be talking about that at this point. Whereas some people read that as being the real agenda is, how much is this going to cost and how long will I have to pay as a taxpayer in the United States or the United Kingdom, for a seawall, in somewhere in West Africa, and why on earth am I going to tell my voters that they have to pay for that? So how do you answer the concerns that people might have that a shift to adaptation and discussing it more openly, will potentially have these unintended consequences of making people more concerned with how do I protect my community as opposed to being concerned about the broader climate issue?
So firstly, people should, of course, be concerned with how to protect their community. And there's nothing wrong with that. And one of the things we like to do in the Climate Majority Project is to say that loud and proud, because sometimes you get sort of progressivist voices who kind of make it sound as if it's a kind of bad and evil thing if you're trying to look after yourselves. So let's sort of dispose of that one. But look, I take the point of the questions, and of course, you're absolutely right. These are the kind of reasons why adaptation has been a poor relation. So let's talk about climate justice for a moment. Let's talk about global justice. What we say is there is never going to be sufficient money for adaptation, let alone for loss and damage, until we acknowledge, for example, that 1.5 is dead and buried, right? As long as people can carry on playing the game of saying, oh, we can still do it, we can still manage it, then they're gonna say that mitigation and prevention takes center stage and nothing else should be allowed to interfere with it. We never get to the stage of actually paying for those seawalls, et cetera, for those restored wetlands all around the world that are going to help people to adapt and become more resilient until we get to truthfulness and until we get to the point where we are willing to let go of something and willing to get into the gritty reality of adaptation. Liam.
Yeah, another thing to comment on there is just empirically, what is not talking about adaptation actually amounted to, right? And, well, you would say, oh, well, we're going to have all this pressure because if we keep 1.5 alive, then that means we're going to have all these serious efforts in mitigation. Well, what it's translated into is basically inventing projections for, net zero, right? That we're going to invent massive new technologies that take all the CO2 out of the air that, as your listeners, I'm sure know, I mean, nobody really has plans for actually doing this. So we're kind of hoping fusion is going to come along and create enough, excess energy that can power these things. So, that's it's betting on that, right? And that's not, or something along this nature or something, but basically there's no consensus that we all agree on where we can actually draw a plan out how we're actually going to accomplish net zero. I mean, many climate scientists call net zero the new greenwashing, right? Particularly like James Hansen. It's not historically a good thing to be on the wrong side of James Hansen's opinion, right? And that's basically where we're betting on with kind of net zero stuff at this point. And another point to make there is just that we do need to appeal beyond the progressive subculture. And, look, people want to, most people are a little bit more pragmatic, like the progressive subculture that dominates the climate movement tends to be concerned about universal moral goods, right? Sort of, universal moral rules and looking after everybody's welfare. And a lot of other people just openly tell you in focus interviews, they won't say this on Twitter or out loud, but they'll say, I don't really care what happens to people around, the rest of the world. I mean, people will tell you this. If you look at the behavior, that's exactly what it says. So if you want to get people involved in climate action, thinking about it, then maybe think about you know, marketing the whole issue to them that way, because it's going to get them actually wrapping their head around it actively if they're thinking about the future.
There's also an enlightened self-interest case, though, it's worth adding, right? So in relation to why should we fund adaptation in faraway countries of which we know little, there's an enlightened self-interest case in, for example, the prevention of even more mass migration and climate refugees than they're already going to be. So the case can work on multiple levels.
Exactly. We don't make enough enlightened self-interest cases. It's kind of universal moral obligation cases, you know, only.
And I think outside of the progressive bubble, if you like, that, and one of the reasons that we're a little bit different here on this show is that, again, we started and our roots are in kind of very different traditions and coming from this from a technology question perspective. And I think when you talk about there being enlightened self-interests, one of the things that, again, you in line with most people, I think, coming, you know, from this particular background to coming to this project, talk about technology as being something that, you know, is we need to be wary of as being perhaps too much of a panacea, that we don't have to change anything else. As long as we get a new toy, we get something that sucks carbon out of the air. It's a Deus Ex Machina. Solitaire Townsend, I don't know if you know her, refers this to as the Iron Man narrative, you know, where Tony Stark invents something and that just fixes everything. Hooray. And that's, you know, like there are a lot of people for whom that Iron Man narrative who listen to this show, and I would probably be someone in there like, that's cool, actually. Why should we should have definitely have some of that. And we're not going to sell it to people if it's not better and cheaper somehow. But I think you guys deal with this, I think, a lot in your book. As you're going to be speaking Innovation Zero, I imagine you might get this question a lot of people saying, why are you guys not more bullish on the prospects of technology in being a bigger part of the mix when it comes to building this majority?
Well, it's more like, you know, what are we emphasizing that's different that's not already emphasized, right? So, I mean, it's not that new technology isn't great, but I mean, if you just look at like System IQ's reports, right, the systemic, right? I mean, so yeah, I mean, the invention of electric cars or the perfection of it, the battery technology that's coming down the pipe, particularly if you can figure out how to make it with fewer rare earth elements, you know, is of course really promising. And, you know, we're in order to even roll that out at scale, there's one few things that we're saying here. One is that the technology industry should probably get a lot more active in trying to create the markets we need, right? So the technology industry is, you know, there's good things happening. However, it's the idea, the market fundamentalism that's beneath that, that says markets are going to do everything by themselves, which is the most dangerous. And right now, the technology industry is being looked at to perpetuate that. Right. So the problem is that, like, it's not that we can't invent ways of heating materials that are green, right? But if you look at, for example, that's about 40% of emissions. Nobody really thinks that in the near term that we're going to have cost competitive, right? Okay. There's the entrepreneurs who are working on these solutions who probably think this, but if you look at independent analysts, there's very few who think that. You know, we're going to have cost competitive industrial heating methods, cost competitive with fossil fuels, right? So hydrogen could do this, but it could be more expensive, right? So it's not that we're going to get these things passed around. That's usually the way that people sort of avoid the subject. Well, yeah, but we're never going to get those passed. Sure. Mm-hmm. But what you can do is change the conversation, and nobody could change the conversation like the technology industry by saying we're not going to get there by inventing magic bullet solutions. Only where essentially we just let markets operate and they have kind of Bill Gates style, you know, energy technology miracles, right? So Gates himself said this, his first piece on when he announced the miracles initiative, right? He said, well, we're not going to have demand side solutions, which is Gates speak or, you know, Wonk speak for government led. We're going to have supply side solutions, which is cheaper technology. And now his recent book is like, well, actually, we need to reduce the energy, the green energy premium, which is essentially saying he's given up on his, you know, what he said, I think it was 5 years ago at this point, and saying that we need policy, right? He was basically swearing off policy and saying it was politically unrealized.
Oh, yeah. I think, yeah, but yet, so sorry, Rupert, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to add that one way of putting the point in a nice sort of philosophical, paradoxical way, which I sometimes like to do, that Liam just made, is this, that we're accustomed to thinking that the great power of technologists is to make amazing things happen with tech. And of course, that's a real wonderful power. But there is another power that technologists have, which is to admit when they can't do something, right? So it's what Vaclav Havel calls the power of the powerless. So if technologists are willing to come out and say, you know what, you're relying on us to sort this all for you with your supply side solutions, we'd love to be able to do that. But we're here to tell you that we can't do it all ourselves. We don't have the power to make this transformation happen in a trouble-free, easy, smooth way. It's not going to be like that. And that the smoothest it's going to be now is if government steps in, is if regulators step in, is if businesses and technologists and financiers are willing to admit that they can't sort all of this out with the magic of the market.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean, I would love to be able to spend hours diving into all of these things, and I hope at some point we get the chance to do that over a glass of wine or something. But at the meantime, I'm conscious of time, and we kept you. We promised not to keep you all day. So one question I think just to sum up this kind of discussion is important to me is, let's say for a minute that perhaps someone that Liam's going to be speaking to at Innovation Zero hears this, hears all the, reads the book. You know, they sell their startup to Microsoft, Bill Gates, or to Microsoft or someone else. And they go on an ayahuasca retreat and they have an experience that leads them to decide that billion after tax that they've got in their account, they're now going to decide to spend that on climate action because that's what they've decided they want to spend the rest of their resources and their life on. So they have got five choices. They could fund climate litigation to, you know, get more results like the ECHR result that we had in Europe, which might lead to other things. And we're hoping to speak to the dean of the Vermont Law School about a piece of legislation that's going through in Vermont that's going to make headlines worldwide pretty soon. Two, they could become an LP in a climate venture capital fund like 2150 or Pale Blue Dot or something like that. Three, they could fund XR or Just Stop Oil, or, you know, pick your movement. Or D, four, they could fund the Climate Majority Project. Or wildcard, number five, they could quietly ask Taggio Muller which Just Collapse or Prepping Together initiatives that they think that money could be better spent on. So of the five, what's your case you're going to make to that billionaire about why they should be giving, you know, either all or the lion's share of money to Climate Majority Project as opposed to some other initiative?
Well, what a lovely question. We could spend all day just on that question. The first thing I'd like to say is I think it's a great question, particularly because people should be thinking about what to do with their money. I mean, anyone with £1,000 or £1 million or £100 million to spare, and there are a lot of such people who have some money to spare, they should be thinking now what to do with it in a serious kind of way, and just the kind of way that you laid out. I would say one reason for thinking that the kinds of projects that we support, the kinds of organizations that we incubate, the kind of campaigns that we run are worth taking very seriously when trying to ask oneself this question is that we are somewhat less visible, but we have enormous, as yet not at all fully tapped, potentiality to affect transformation. So the radical flank, the XRs and Just Stop Oils of this world, by definition, are highly visible. To enable us to become a highly visible part of the climate movement, to enable people to understand that there is a mass mainstream climate movement that they can be part of without having to be left-wing or progressive or an activist even, this is a crucial project. And that is basically our project. So the kinds of things we're trying to do with SAFER, with Resourcing Climate Distress, with the campaign to get business people and technologists to ask for regulation, to get them to lobby for it, to get them to admit that they can't do it by themselves. These are crucial kind of moves in the space. And they are at the moment woefully under-resourced.
Yeah, I mean, another thing is basically the initiatives that you mentioned have these kind of theories of change where it's like, you know, there's a taste for definitiveness rather than correctness. So we want a 4-point easy theory of change, right? So, and there's this kind of, I liken it like, essentially, there's a mountain range. We're kind of on one side of it, and we want to cross over to the other side. So sustainability land, right? And there's a very high mountain in between us where there's, you know, better sustainable lives. And what a lot of, because that mountain is so intimidating, the political route, we know one route that's up there. It involves organizing a majority to ask for different laws. Because that's intimidating, we look for mountain passes, right? And everything else you named essentially is either not crossing or it all sort of basically, well, we're going to find somewhere else. We can't get there, right? So that's the collapse scenario. Or finding a mountain pass because we're intimidated by the journey, right? The reality is at this late stage, we already are kind of like where we're at is already deteriorating. There's enough people who realize that, okay, we actually have to cross the mountain pass, right? That's like the most underfunded area, right? So you have to just, there's not actually a way over without politics. And I think that's kind of what we, if you read the theory of change, especially, that's kind of more largely the point that we make is that essentially we're running away from politics because it's intimidating, right? And so what we need is people who are really ready to embrace that, which is, you know, what CMP is doing.
Okay. Well, look, I mean, I know that we wanted to talk a little bit more about the Regulate Us campaign. So, but that also leads us into how people can get more information, potentially come involved. So tell us about the Regulate Us campaign and what that's about and why people should consider getting involved.
Well, it's basically, you know, what we spoke about earlier with it, which there's a basically I call it like market cancellation. So if you think of you have some people where you know, we have like the progressive and the progressive, you know, bubble, you have cancellation because you get, you know, you run afoul of progressive dogma. You know, there's also market dogma. Most people don't believe it, you know, who are, you know, it's actually a relatively small minority of people who really believe markets are going to solve everything. If you talk to people, most people don't believe it, but it's enormously influential. So more people have to flout that ideology openly. And so Regulate Us is really about just getting people to open their mouths and push the Overton window and say openly, look, yeah, we need, actually, we're calling it Regulate Us with an exclamation point, better in parentheses, right? So that, you know, we know that people are not expecting the government to suddenly start doing brilliantly. What you need is kind of like enthusiastic, knowledgeable business people suggesting much better versions of regulation, having transparent discussions, and we, you know, work towards this together, expecting, you know, great orders to come on down from high. But we need to break the kind of taboo about discussing the fact that, yeah, we're going to get there with new laws and industry working together, a public-private partnership that's realistic, intelligent, informed, you know, and right now that's really not happening, right? If you look at like conference sessions, so what we're doing in Innovation Zero will probably be the first of its kind in, I think, 4 years. So actually getting like business people talking about what type of regulatory environment should we be helping to lobby for, not reacting to what the government's going to do, but what should we be lobbying for to help steer towards a sustainable world? Like, that's not something that's even on conferences. So you can say that, oh, people know this, but well, if you look at conference content, doesn't really look like that's what we're talking about, right? So it's about like raising your voice and saying like, why isn't the Harvard Business School, you know, sustainability conference featuring this? Why are there more sessions on fusion than there are on an ideal regulatory environment to use the technology we have to get to net zero in a sustainable way, right? Like that should be the center of the conversation. And it's not.
Well, look, this has been really, thank you both for your time. I've really enjoyed this conversation. I would love it to be able to go on for longer, but I know you guys have other things to do. So where can people get more information about the Climate Majority Project and to follow, you know, both of you have prolific writing and other kind of media output. So where can they first get information about the project and then on both of you?
Well, do read the book, The Climate Majority Project, available at all good bookshops and also online. Do go to our website, climatemajorityproject.com. Do follow us on socials. But all of that is really just the beginning. The crucial thing to understand about the Climate Majority Project is we are, if you will, the very thin end of a very large wedge, right? We want to enable something to happen, which is, and to help it, and it's already happening, as I was describing earlier, to enable it to happen fully, which is so kind of huge and monumental. Think what it actually means for 25% of the population, and then eventually, you know, the majority, to actually get active, doing stuff, where they live, where they pray, where they work, whatever it is that they're involved in, which could be something which could make a real difference. Ultimately, the Climate Majority Project is about you, whoever you are who's listening to this, about you stepping into your full power, maybe working in a group of fellow technologists, if that's the game that you're in, maybe engaging that power of the powerless that I mentioned earlier. Find what the path for you is. A key part of what our work is helping other people to find what their work is, to be part of this enormous, loosely coordinated network effort. And that's what it's going to take. And it is coming. The only question is it going to be big enough? Is it going to be fast enough? Is it going to be wide enough? Is it going to be wise enough? But it is coming. So find your part in it. That's what it's really about.
And Innovation Zero. So
at Innovation Zero, 100%. Well, we look forward to seeing you there, and I hope you'll stick around for the drinks afterwards, Liam. But we'll catch you there in any case. They'll track you down on the Olympia. So listen, thank you both for coming on, and I hope we'll be seeing you again soon. You hope to come back on the show.
Yeah, let's do it again sometime.
Yeah, really great.
That'd be great. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening to Wicked Problems, made possible through the generosity of people like you. If you liked this conversation, please share it and leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It really helps people find the show. If you'd like an ad-free version of this podcast, consider becoming a paid subscriber at wickedproblems.earth. You'll also get our newsletter, all our show notes, member-only goodies, and you'll be supporting media that wants to tell the stories at the frontier of climate tech, the place where people and politics, technology and capital meet and shape the future. And whether it's one you'd want to live in. Wicked Problems is written and edited by Richard Delavan. Production assistance was provided by me, Theodore Delavan. Wicked Problems, Climate Tech Conversations, is a production of Wicked Problems Limited. Thanks again for listening.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Confidence starts with loving who you are. And when your skin feels nourished and glows on the outside, you naturally radiate confidence from the inside. Give your skin a glow up with Osea's clinically proven Mega Moisture Duo. This ultra-hydrating body care features two of Osea's best sellers, Undaria Algae Body Oil and Undaria Collagen Body Lotion. These seaweed-powered heroes use skincare-level ingredients normally reserved for your face for results you can see and confidence you can feel. Osea has been making clean, clinically proven seaweed-infused face and body care products for over 28 years. This luxurious skincare is vegan, cruelty-free, and climate-neutral certified, so you never have to choose between your values and your best skin. Glow from the inside out. Get 10% off your first order with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code GLOW.